Good evening, and welcome to the October presentation in our fifth season of Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate the series with my colleague Peggy Wright, with assistance from our webmaster, Haiwang Wan, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. David Runner is our technology coordinator. Our speaker tonight hails from Connecticut. After completing his education, he spent 7 years in New York working for several top advertising agencies, including Young and Rubicam, McCann Erickson, and Ogilvy and Mather. After moving to Kentucky in 1991, he started the first direct response division at a Louisville advertising agency and served 2 terms as president of the Louisville Direct Marketing Association. He joined Heaven Hill Distilleries Incorporated in 1997 as group marketing manager with responsibility for all American, Irish, Scotch, and Canadian whiskey brands. In 2002, he was appointed to a newly created position as director of corporate communications with responsibility for leading the company's internal communications and external programs to wholesale customers, media, and consumers, both domestic and international. He's a frequent speaker at universities and to service and consumer groups and is a widely quoted source on the distilled spirits and whiskey industries. Heaven Hill is America's largest independent family-owned distilled spirits producer and marketer and is the world's second largest holder of aging Kentucky bourbon. Their pomegranate liqueur has drawn a lot of national publicity this year and is one of the hot new drinks in nightclubs and restaurants. Larry calls Louisville home these days, which he shares with his wife, 2 daughters, and a 120-gallon saltwater reef aquarium. Here to tell us more about one of Kentucky's most famous companies, Larry Cass.
Thanks for having me here. And I must admit that I'm somewhat pleased that it's gotten to be like 40 degrees out here because nobody really wants to talk about bourbon when it's 80 degrees out. So, as Brian mentioned, I'm the Director of Corporate Communications for Heaven Hill Distilleries in Bardstown, and I'm going to spend a little time talking about bourbon and the bourbon industry in Kentucky. And I understand that this series, y'all can hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, because I never know about these things. That this series has been going on some time, but this is the first time that you all have had a chance to talk about bourbon whiskey and the bourbon industry, which is, I guess, great that I have the opportunity to do this. But to my mind, it's a shame that you haven't had a chance to talk about the bourbon industry because it is kind of one of the real signature industries in the state of Kentucky. And as I mentioned, whenever, I always find it interesting that whenever the state of Kentucky has any kind of important event, whenever they have dignitaries in, whenever there's a governor's conference, whenever they have important legislators in, invariably they will ask all the distilleries to come in and do a bourbon tasting because they're very, very proud of the bourbon industry and proud of it being kind of one of the keystone heritage industries of the state of Kentucky. So research always shows that no matter where you go in the world, when you mention the state of Kentucky to people, they kind of think of horses, fried chicken, and bourbon. So it really is kind of one of the things that people think of when they think of the state of Kentucky. But it is one of the things that kind of a lot of people from the state of Kentucky kind of know something about and think they know something about, but perhaps don't know as much about as they think they know about. So anyway, I hope to spend a little time talking to you tonight about... and here we go, it works. We're going to talk a little bit about the bourbon industry and my company. Let's see if I can put that over here. Which really is kind of unique in the bourbon industry today, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And we're going to talk a little bit about what bourbon is and define it. We're going to talk a little bit about the history of bourbon and its relationship and interrelationship with the history of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, because interestingly enough, the birth of the Commonwealth of Kentucky really is intertwined with the birth and the history of bourbon, believe it or not, and I will talk a bit about that. I'll give you a kind of a quick primer on the bourbon-making process. And then we'll spend just a minute or two discussing the economic impact of the bourbon industry in Kentucky because it is, in fact, profound. First, we'll talk a little bit about Heaven Hill Distilleries. Of all the bourbon that's produced in the world, and that's last year that was about 920,000 barrels of bourbon. There's about 53 gallons of bourbon in a barrel. So that's about 48,760,000 gallons were produced last year. When you translate that into boxes of bourbon or cases of bourbon, it's about 14.2 million 9-liter cases of bourbon were sold in 2005. But all of that whiskey comes out of only 8 distilleries. There's lots of people that actually bottle bourbon, but there's only 8 of us that actually make it. There's people that buy it and from the distilleries and bottle it, but there's only 8 of us that make it. And of the 8 that make it, there's only one left that's actually still family-owned and independent, and that's Heaven Hill Distilleries. Back in the day, they were all independent, family-owned companies. These were started by families, run by families. The master distillers were usually from those families. But over time, these were all bought up by multinational companies, often foreign-owned international conglomerates, who not only made bourbon, they also made beer and wine, they also made golf clubs, and they also made plumbing fixtures, and they also made shoes and locks and things like that. Heaven Hill Distilleries is different. We are the only ones left that are independent, family-owned. We were founded in 1934 by a family, and we're still run by that family. The second generation currently runs it, and they just brought in the third generation, actually. So we have the world's second largest, even though we're independent and family-owned, we're very large. We have the world's second largest holdings of bourbon. We have about 700,000 barrels aging in our facilities in Nelson County. It's about 17% of the world's inventory of bourbon. We bottle about 30,000 cases of distilled spirits, and that's not just bourbon, a day in our facilities in Nelson County. I think I just mentioned that we were founded in 1934, right after Prohibition ended. When they knew that Prohibition was going to end, a lot of people that were in the bourbon industry before Prohibition said, okay, let's get into the bourbon industry again, and there was a big rush just to open distilleries. And what happened was some people that were in the bourbon industry approached the Shapira family, who were not in the whiskey industry, as investors, and they said, we're going to open a bourbon distillery. We need you to provide some seed money as investors, and we'll buy you out in a few years. You'll make some money. We'll make some money. Just the opposite happened. The Shapiras ended up buying them out in 5 years, and they ended up running the company. So, and as they said, when they did this in 1934, it was the height of the Depression. They didn't know anything about distilling bourbon. It was really tantamount to kind of, it was probably more speculative than the dot-com business was in the 1980s, so it was a great risk. So, founded in 1934 by the Shapira family, but aside from bourbon, even though bourbon really is our heart and soul, as we say, and we grew up a bourbon producer, we are a completely diversified spirits producer, so we have Evan Williams Black Label, which is the second largest bourbon in the country today behind Jim Beam White Label, that conveniently knocks out Jack Daniels because they're a Tennessee whiskey, they're not a bourbon. And I'll tell you the difference of those in a minute. So we have our Evan Williams Black Label, and we have an Evan Williams Single Barrel, which is a super premium version of that. And we have Elijah Craig, which is a small batch bourbon, and we have Henry McKenna, which is another bourbon. So we're a great bourbon maker, but aside from that, we're diversified, so we have brands like Christian Brothers Brandy, and we have brands like Burnett's Vodka, and brands like Dubonnet, which is an aperitif. And then some of the younger people here may be familiar with a brand called Hypnotic that we have, which is very popular. And then we mentioned the pomegranate liqueur we have as well. So nowadays it's important to be diversified because, well, 10 years ago, the bourbon business wasn't so good. People weren't drinking as much bourbon. The bourbon business is great, and I'll talk about this in a few minutes. The bourbon business has really gotten good lately, but it's important to diversify your product portfolio because obviously you got to make sure that as the product categories kind of come and go in terms of popularity, that you're broadly diversified in terms of your product offerings. So that's a little bit about Heaven Hill Distilleries, but we are unique in the bourbon industry because we're independent, we're family-owned, but yet we're big. We're a very big player in the business. So now we're going to talk a little bit about what is bourbon. So this is one of these questions that it just drives me crazy when I ask people in the spirits business, in the distilled spirits business, what bourbon is. They don't know, and they ask me what's the difference between bourbon and whiskey. It just drives me crazy. It makes me want to beat my head against the wall. People that are in the business don't know the difference, but I'm going to try and explain this in a way that's hopefully y'all will understand a little bit about this. So bourbon is, first of all, it's classified, and the government is the one that does all this classification, so if people don't understand it, I figure that's probably why. But it's classified as, first of all, as a type of American whiskey. And there are several different types of American whiskeys, according to the government. There are, first of all, straight whiskeys, and that's the big one that we're going to have to remember is straight whiskeys. But aside from straight whiskeys, there's things called blended whiskeys and light whiskeys. And we'll define those as well. But first, let's talk about straight whiskeys, since that's what bourbon is. So what is a straight whiskey? Well, a straight whiskey has to meet a set of criteria. And I'll explain how bourbon is made, but basically a whiskey is made up of grains. It's grains that are cooked with water to break down the starches, and then they're fermented. Yeast is added to them, and they're fermented like a wine or beer is fermented. It's a natural process that converts the starches to sugar and alcohol. And then it goes a step beyond what beer or wine does. It's distilled. You run it through a still, and you allow, basically, you blast that fermented product with steam, and because alcohol evaporates at a lower temperature than water, when you blast it with steam, the alcohol will bloom off of that beer, and it rises off in a vapor, and once you condense that, that vapor becomes whiskey. But what you make that whiskey with is prescribed by the government as at least 51% of a single type of grain plus a mixture of other grains. Simple enough, okay? 51% of a single type of grain plus a mixture of other grains. First criteria for straight whiskey. Second criteria for straight whiskey is that it has to come off the still at a certain proof, 160, and it has to go into the barrel at a certain proof, 125. So basically it comes off the still, it's reduced with water, and it goes into the barrel at 125 proof. That is what it is. This is an important one. Straight whiskey has to age a minimum of 2 years in a new charred oak barrel. It can't age in a used barrel. It has to age in a new charred oak for a minimum of 2 years in order to be called a straight whiskey, okay? And that is a specific criteria that's unique to a straight whiskey. And you'll see why that's important in just a minute or two. Okay, so those are your criteria for straight whiskey. And one more very, very important one is no additives. Brian mentioned earlier that when I was a marketing manager at Heaven Hill before the position I'm in now, I was a marketing manager for American, Irish, Scotch, and Canadian whiskeys, all of which we have. American straight whiskey is the only ones that meet this criteria. In Scotland, if their Scotch whiskey is a little too light, they add caramel color to it to darken it. Same thing in Ireland. They can do that in Canada, too. We can't do that in America. We can't add any coloring, blending, or flavoring additives to the whiskey. Once it goes into the barrel, that's it. We can't do anything to it. When it comes out, a minimum of 2 years later, as we said earlier, in order to be called a straight whiskey, it has to age a minimum of 2 years. It's got to be right. If we screw up, that's it. Sorry, you've wasted your money. So no additives. It's, in the marketing speak, it's the world's only all natural whiskey, if you really want to talk about it that way. So these are the criteria that it has to meet in order to be called a straight whiskey. Real quickly, let's talk about blended whiskeys. I'm just going to tell you about this because, believe it or not, in the 40s and 50s, the number one distilled spirit in the country was always a blended whiskey. Seagram's 7 Crown, Seagram's VO, Kessler. These were the top-selling spirit, not just whiskey, spirit. I mean, now it's Bacardi Rum or Smirnoff Vodka. Those are the top-selling spirits in the country. It was always a blended whiskey. These were always the top-selling spirits. Certainly not the case anymore. Nobody drinks blended whiskeys anymore, but they used to be the top-selling spirits in the country. But blended whiskeys are essentially built from a blend of, at a minimum of 20% straight whiskeys, which we just defined, plus grain neutral spirits. So they're built, they're blended. And it's actually somewhat of an art to make blended whiskeys, though it's a dying art, as I mentioned. But these may include what I talked about earlier, these coloring, flavoring, or blending agents. So those are your blended whiskeys. These are the other two, three types of American whiskeys that I spoke of, straight whiskeys, blended whiskeys, and finally, light whiskeys. Very tiny category that they tried. In the 70s, you could get some light whiskeys. These were distilled at higher proof. These could be aged in used or new barrels, okay? So again, we've tried to narrow this down a little bit. What is bourbon? It's a type of American whiskey. It's a type of straight American whiskey. Now we have to narrow it down a little farther. So there's straight American whiskey types. There's four of them. There's bourbon whiskey, there's Tennessee whiskey, there's rye whiskey, and there's corn whiskey. So these all meet those criteria of being a straight whiskey and an American whiskey. How are these different from each other? Everybody following me so far? Okay. Bourbon whiskey, the difference that bourbon whiskey, the unique criteria for bourbon whiskey is that 51% is corn. Okay? 51% corn plus malted barley plus usually rye is the third grain. In the case of some brands like Maker's Mark, our Old Fitzgerald, W.L. Weller, a few brands, they'll use wheat, called the wheated bourbon. So the mash bill in bourbon, minimum of 51% corn, though it's always usually in the 70s, much higher than 51%, but it's got to be a minimum of 51%. So that's the first criteria for bourbon whiskey. We mentioned in order to be a straight whiskey, it has to age a minimum of 2 years in a new charred oak barrel. But in bourbon whiskey, they take that kind of a step further. The age has to be disclosed on the label if it's less than 4 years old. The reason that I'm pointing this out is, if you look at the label on a whiskey bottle, and there's no age statement there, odds are it's 4 years old, which is the minimum age it has to be in order to not disclose it. If it's older than that, odds are they'll say it on the label, because it becomes a competitive advantage at that point. Because age, generally more age on a bourbon is good. The more it ages, the more taste flavor components it gets from the barrel, and you'll see that in the price generally. So it's just a little hint there. Because there's the law that says that the age must be disclosed if it's less than 4 years, nobody wants to put something on there that says this whiskey is less than 4 years old. So if there's no age statement on, generally it's going to be a 4. Jim Beam White Label, no age statement, it's a 4-year-old whiskey. So that's bourbon whiskey. Tennessee whiskey, which Jack Daniel's and George Dickel, those are the only two ones that are left that come out of Tennessee anymore. It conforms to all the standards that we just reviewed for bourbon whiskey, except it adds one thing, which anybody that has ever looked at a Jack Daniel's ad will know. They filter it through these ricks of sugar maple charcoal, and then through this wool, and then more. And that's what they call the Lincoln County process. But they do that before it goes into the barrel. So it gives it this particular flavor, kind of a sooty flavor, a charcoal-y flavor. So that's Tennessee whiskey. Rye whiskey, the mash bill's got to contain a minimum of 51% of a single grain. Duh, in rye, it's rye. So rye whiskey's actually making a big comeback. So that's like the next new hot whiskey's rye. So we actually just introduced a rye whiskey that's 21 years old, a single barrel rye whiskey, and we're charging $150 a bottle for it, and we're going to sell every bottle we can make. So hooray for rye whiskey, I say. So, and then the fourth type of straight whiskey that I'm going to mention is corn whiskey. This is kind of the sixth sister of the straight whiskey set here. There's only one company left that makes corn whiskey. Corn whiskey, the mash bill here, for bourbon, it's got to contain a minimum of 51%. Well, for corn whiskey, it's got to contain a minimum of 80% corn. So corn whiskey's got a lot of corn to it. That's no surprise. There's no minimum aging requirements for corn whiskey. We make a corn whiskey at Heaven Hill called Georgia Moon. And it actually, it's kind of what we call a novelty brand. It actually comes in a mason jar. And our little logo for it is less than 30 days old, The more you swaller, the less you holler. It's really a novelty brand. It's not a sip and whiskey. But there's no minimum aging requirements for corn whiskey, so you know you can do that stuff with it. But we also make a very good corn whiskey, a bottled and bond aged corn whiskey, which a lot of the great whiskey writers say is just a great corn whiskey. So there's no minimum aging requirements. The other thing about corn whiskey is if you do age it, you don't have to age it in new cooperage, in a new barrel. You can age it in a used barrel. And I mentioned that limited suppliers remain. Well, you can guess who that limited supplier that remains is. That would be Heaven Hill Distilleries. We are the only ones left in the world that still make corn whiskey. So, you know, people have discovered bourbon and single barrel bourbons and small batch bourbons. I mentioned rye whiskeys. People are way onto rye whiskeys right now. The only straight whiskey that's left that's left to discover is corn whiskey. So that's what I'm pushing. We're the only ones left that make it. So corn whiskey's next. So anyway. Okay, we've talked a little bit about what the bourbon is. So we've defined kind of the categories, and this is the way the government does it. So we've defined kind of American whiskeys, straight whiskeys, the types of straight whiskeys, and it brings us down to bourbon. So now we understand a little bit about what bourbon whiskey is. So we'll talk a little bit now about the history of bourbon. And you can see kind of some of the shady characters that were involved in the history of bourbon there. But it is really a fascinating story about the history of bourbon, because I said that the history of the Commonwealth really is intertwined with the history of bourbon, and it really is. But we'll talk a little bit about, in the most broadly sweeping and general terms, kind of a little bit about colonial distillers and then the Western movement of settlers, many of whom knew a lot about distillation, and then the birth of bourbon here in Kentucky and kind of why that happened here. The colonial distillers, obviously, when the pilgrims and the settlers first came over here, life was tough here, hostile Indians, disease, the water wasn't very good. They had need, and I would argue probably desire, to produce spirits. And they made spirits from everything. I mean, gourds, pumpkins, I mean, anything is fermentable. So, and anything that would ferment, they would make spirits from. And these were people that would make spirits in their home countries, and they brought that knowledge of the still over with them. So the pilgrims produced beers from acorns, from squash, from gourds. There's historical records of all these things. Mead, which was made from honey, obviously wine. They brought small portable stills over with them on their ships from Europe. And there's obviously a long history of distillation. This is a long subject, but you know, the history of distillation goes back to farmers who grew grains in years when they had bumper crops. If you had a bumper crop, you kind of had two choices. You could either watch it rot, or you could do something with it to store it, make it portable so you could bring it to market, and maybe do something with it to make what was probably a pretty rough life maybe a little bit better once in a while, which was to distill it. So there was a tradition for farmers taking their excess grain and distilling it. So farmers would, there was this tradition from Europe of taking their excess grain and turning it into distilled spirits, which is what they would do. But of course, as we know from our American history, there was this thing called the triangle trade, which involved molasses, slaves, and rum being traded in between Europe, America, and Africa. And until the triangle trade was broken in 1808, rum was the primary spirit of colonial America. And that was the main spirit that was made. So the history of rum was really, of bourbon was really set up in colonial distillers through these early spirits, the history, the knowledge of the alembic still, the early stills, and the triangle trade in rum. But with the initial Western movement of settlers, many of whom were what we call Ulstermen, Scotch Irishmen, and Germans, who were very, very knowledgeable in the use of the still. Nearly a million of these folks arrived by 1776. And many of these people went into Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. And at that point, if you know your history of Kentucky, Kentucky was actually Fincastle County, Virginia. It was not a state at that point. It was a county of Virginia. And at that point, the grains that grew in Pennsylvania and Maryland and Virginia and the east coast of the United States, the grain that grew there easiest was rye. And that was the main whiskey that they were making at that point was rye. And in 1794, here's an interesting fact for you, the first time that General Washington mustered troops under the new Constitution, tested the powers of the new Constitution, in fact, was to put down the Whiskey Rebellion in 1794. And that was because the government was trying to essentially recoup some of the war debt from the Revolutionary War. And the way they did that was, the way they usually do that was, sin tax. They decided to tax whiskey distillers in Pennsylvania. And as is usually the case, the whiskey distillers said, no way, and they essentially rebelled, so they sent a bunch of revenuers in, and it was a fairly sizable rebellion in western Pennsylvania. And in 1794, and they were producing what was called Monongahela Rye in the Monongahela River in western Pennsylvania, the Whiskey Rebellion of 1794. And at that point, whiskey was beginning to kind of make a name for itself in America. And as that happened, folks began arriving from western Pennsylvania into eastern Kentucky, including a guy named Daniel Boone. In 1767, he arrived. I mentioned in 1776, Kentucky County was formed. It was Fincastle County, and in 1776, it was named Kentucky County. That same year, the Virginia legislature passed what was called the Corn Patch and Cabin Rights Law. And this law was an important law, and I talked about the history of bourbon and the history of the Commonwealth of Kentucky kind of crossing. And this is really where it crossed, because when they passed, this was a law that they passed to basically incent people to go settle Kentucky, because they were having a lot of trouble getting people to move to Kentucky, because it was a pretty rough territory at that point. And what this law said was, if you would go to Kentucky County, Virginia, and you would plant an acre of corn, you got to keep 22 acres around it. So what that meant was, people would go there and they would plant corn. So I mentioned farmers would go and they'd plant, and excess, and any excess grains they'd have, they'd turn into whiskey. So plant corn, excess corn, turn it into corn liquor. So you kind of had this scenario whereby people would plant corn. And they were doing it to get people to settle the land. So there you have it. Intersection of bourbon history and settling of the state of Kentucky. So Corn Patch and Cabin Rights Law being passed really kind of created the stage for corn to be planted in Kentucky, and for corn liquor to be made, and for bourbon to be created, essentially. So therefore the settlers moved westward in droves into Kentucky County. So the birth of bourbon, like that, the birth of bourbon in the state of Kentucky. And you really had kind of this crucible, this natural cradle in Kentucky. I'll say this first. One of the real myths about bourbon, and people ask me all the time, bourbon has to be made in Kentucky. Wrong. The government, that's a complete myth. Bourbon does not have to be made in Kentucky. But the president of the Kentucky Distillers Association has a great saying. He says, if you want to sell it, you damn well better make it in Kentucky. Because the conditions here in Kentucky are uniquely ideal to making bourbon. You can't really make it anywhere else because of a series of conditions that have to be right for making bourbon. And these have to do with these natural conditions. First of all, you need the grains, okay? And we talked about the fact that corn is the main grain that's made in Kentucky, and by chance, the early settlers grew corn, and obviously corn grows very, very well here. And there's arable land, and that's why the corn grows well here. Hardwood trees. When the settlers first arrived here, there were 17 types of oak trees that were growing here in Kentucky. And one of them, the American white oak, Quercus typus, just happens to be the most perfect type of wood for making a barrel. When you char this wood, it has this substance in it that not only forms a perfectly watertight seal, but when you char it, it and the whiskey goes into that char layer in the winter and comes back out in the summer. It takes on this perfect flavor and color. And it also has these compounds in it so that it allows the water to evaporate, but the alcohol molecules, because they're larger, do not. And that's what they call the angel share. So when you go into a whiskey warehouse and you smell, what you're smelling is you're smelling essentially evaporating angel share, we call it. It's evaporating whiskey, but the proof in the barrels is going up. It's water evaporating, but the alcohol stays in the barrels. So again, you have this natural abundance of these perfect trees for making barrels out of. The other thing that you had here, and this really is kind of where it all starts. Distilleries go where the water is A, plentiful, and B, right for producing the whiskey. Here in Kentucky, we have this geological formation that goes right down the middle of the state. If any of you all are familiar with taking courses on this, it's the Pennyroyal Plateau, or the Highland Rim, it's called. It's, of course, if you run your faucet or go in your shower, you know we have really hard water here in Kentucky. It's this famous limestone water that, you know, produces the bluegrass and gives the thoroughbreds their great bones and all this stuff that you read about. But it really is true. It's the limestone water that occurs here in Kentucky that really is probably the greatest secret to the bourbon that we have here, because it comes up out of the water through the limestone, and it's naturally filtered, and it's iron-free. And iron is the natural enemy of the distillation process. If you take, that's why, incidentally, there's no nails or any metal that's used in a whiskey barrel. If any metal is exposed to whiskey, it turns it black. You can't have any iron or any metal in the whiskey making process at all, other than copper. So the water that comes up, bubbles up through all these wonderful springs that we have here in Kentucky through this limestone shelf, is iron-free, and it's also filled with all these minerals. And those minerals, we don't quite understand this, but we believe that during the fermentation process, these minerals aid the yeast, and nutrients aid in the fermentation process. So we have this incredible water. And once you go too far east or too far west, you get off that limestone shelf, and you can't make bourbon anymore. There were distilleries at one point in Owensboro and in far western Kentucky. There were distilleries in far eastern Kentucky, and they've all closed down and they don't run anymore. Parker Beam, our master distiller, says it's because they can't make bourbon worth, you know. Medley Distillery in Owensboro, they're not around anymore. It's because they're not in the limestone shelf anymore. But the Lynchburg, Tennessee, and Cascade Hollow, where George Dickel is, it extends down into central Tennessee, that same limestone shelf. So those distilleries in Tennessee benefit from that same water that we get here in central Kentucky. So same thing in Ireland and Scotland. It's totally different. They have, most of them have soft water, but distilleries go where the water is right. So anyway, you see the picture here is we have this confluence, kind of this perfect storm of natural elements that make bourbon making, first of all, created the conditions by which bourbon could be born, but continue to make the conditions under which bourbon can be made here. So this is why you can't make bourbon in Montana, or you can't make bourbon in Maine. I mean, you can only make it here where the water, and the other thing that I should point out is the aging conditions. We have four seasons here in Kentucky. So when we put the whiskey in the barrel and we have this cold nights, and the whiskey comes into the barrel when it's cold, and we have the hot days, and it goes out into the wood and goes through that char layer, and it's that movement in and out of that char layer and in and out of that barrel that gives the whiskey its color and its flavor. So again, here in Kentucky, it's the natural cradle of the birth of bourbon. So some of the earliest bourbon makers up in the Bardstown area, relative of Daniel Boone, Waddy Boone, Evan Williams, who again our brand is named after, up on the Ohio River, was Kentucky's first commercial distiller. The Reverend Elijah Craig, a Baptist minister, I kid you not, in Scott County, Georgetown, He was a farmer, a distiller as well. He's the one that's actually credited with charring the barrels for the first time. The story goes that he had a barn fire and was too frugal to throw his barrels out, and he put his whiskey up in them. And what they would do is they would put the whiskey in, I'll talk about this in a minute, they'd put them in flatboats up in Maysville, which was called Bourbon County at that point, and they'd float them down the Ohio to the Mississippi, and they'd float them down to New Orleans or Jackson, usually was the markets for bourbon. And that journey could take 6 months sometimes. And in that 6 months, the Reverend Craig's whiskey, when they opened it up, they noticed that that whiskey in those burned barrels had gotten a little color to it, and that the taste was, I don't know if I'd say better, I would argue back in 1789, probably less bad than the whiskey that they were drinking back then. So somebody said, man, maybe there's something to this, you know, charred barrel. So that's how the story goes that the Reverend Craig discovered the charred barrels. So a fellow named Elijah Pepper, who was in the Lexington area, and then a fellow named Jacob Beam, our master distillers are Parker and Craig Beam, who are the great and a grandnephew and great-grandnephew of Jim Beam, actually. Jim Beam doesn't even have Beams left as their master distillers. Every drop of whiskey that's ever been produced at Heaven Hill has been produced by a Beam. There's not even Beams left at Beam. So, I mentioned the charred oak barrels, which was a legacy of Elijah Craig. The aging in flatboats, I also mentioned, there's a flatboat right there. And you know what they do with these flatboats when they get them down to New Orleans, of course, is they break them up for firewood because you couldn't get a flatboat back up the river when you think about it. So, and they started calling this product what Reverend Craig's product. It would take on a little color, this red liquor from Bourbon County, which was where Maysville was, which they then shortened to Bourbon County liquor, which they then shortened to bourbon. So, the sour mash process that you've all heard about, that's the returning of the prior day's production to the current day's production, kind of like sourdough bread, that's the same idea. That really has more to do with pH and sanitary control than anything else. But that actually, interestingly enough, was discovered, we don't like to really talk about this a lot in the bourbon industry, was discovered by a Scotsman, Dr. James Crowe. But he came here and produced Old Crow, was actually named after Dr. Crow. But he's the one that's responsible for the sour mash process. Real quickly, I'm going to just talk real quickly about the bourbon making process. And I have this fancy flow chart to do this. And the only reason I wanted to do this was so I could use my laser pointer. So, what happens, it's basically, I'll just break it up into four stages for you. There are, I mentioned the grains that are involved in the bourbon making process, corn being the main one. Typically, you always will have malted barley for the second one. Boy, my hands shake when I use this thing, don't they? Rye would typically be the third grain. These are all rye-based bourbons. There's like I said, there's Maker's Mark is the most well-known. Old Fitzgerald is our wheated bourbon. But most of them use rye as the third grain. Grains will come into the distillery in full form as kernels, full kernels. And we inspect them, check them for moisture, test them, do all those things on them. And then what we do is we mill them first. And what you do is you basically just use one of two types of mills, and you just mill it down to basically a flour consistency, a really fine consistency. And essentially what we're doing first is we are going to take that grain and we're going to cook it. And the reason we cook it is we want the fermentation process to be able to break down the sugars, the starches that are in those grains. And you have to cook the grains first in order to do that. So this is called the mashing process. You've heard about mashing or mash tubs or mash bells or other things. So what we do is we essentially, here, I'll do my little animation there. Grains will go in and they will be milled, isn't that cool? And then they'll go around in, they're weighed and then they're dropped into the mash tub in a certain order. Corn goes in first, it's cooked for a certain period of time, it's cooled. Malted barley goes in, it's cooked for a certain period of time, cooled. Rye goes in for a certain period of time, it's cooled. It essentially goes into a big kettle, cooked. Then once that's done, it's cooled, and it goes then into the fermentation process. Okay. Come on, baby. Okay, then we go into the fermentation process. Fermentation involves yeast. Yeast is the catalyst that ferments. So every distillery has its own yeast formula. This is like the secret family guarded tradition. And it is. The yeast is the key, it's one of the key flavor components of any bourbon. It's a fascinating thing about yeast. Yeast is a living substance and you have to keep it alive. And nowadays we keep yeast alive in a refrigerator. Back in like the 18th century, during the summer, they would take the yeast cultures and they would put it in a special kind of a copper jug, and they would take it and they'd find a spring and they'd attach it to a weight and they'd sink it to the bottom of the spring for the whole summer. It would be the only way they could keep the yeast strain. I mean, this is the stuff that they would have to do to keep the yeast strains alive. It was amazing. And if they lost their yeast strain, they were dead. So, I mean, it's just amazing the stuff that they would have to do to keep this yeast strain alive. So, and distilleries have lost their, you know, I mean, as recently as 30, 40 years ago, distilleries have lost their yeast strains. So it's very, very important. The yeast is prepared in a special donut tub. It's a whole process. So the yeast is added to this cooked mash. The cooked mash is like a wonderful porridge. Whenever I go to the distillery, I go up to the mash tubs. If they're going, I'll kind of reach in there. If it's not going too much, I'll grab a little on my finger and I'll taste it. It's like the best, sweetest porridge or cereal you've ever had. We'll take that stuff, we add the yeast to it, and we put it in these enormous fermenters. And then after about 2 days, you open these fermenters up, and the stuff is just boiling and bubbling. And every once in a while, you can get somebody, you can sucker somebody to sticking their head in there. Because carbon dioxide, bad mistake there. Carbon dioxide is a byproduct of the fermentation process. If it was carbon monoxide, we'd be in real trouble. Carbon dioxide is a byproduct. But it really, when somebody puts their head over a fermentation vat, this carbon dioxide comes off and it knocks your socks off. We had a journalist there once, and he put his head over this thing, and he went flying backwards. His glasses went flying about 20 feet back into another of the fermentation bag. He lost his glasses in the fermentation bag. I mean, it is a violent process. In Scotland, where they make their whiskey with just malted barley, and the malted barley is the most enzymatically active of all the grains, they actually have to pass a big propeller over the fermentation vats because it froths so violently. They actually have to skim this stuff off. It's amazing to look in there and see this stuff bubbling and all this gas coming off it. But after several days, the fermentation process is over and you have what's called beer. It's called a distiller's beer. It's not exactly like your Budweiser beer. It's not a beer you'd want to drink. It's a thick, very thick beer, and it's about 9% alcohol at that point. And we take this thick beer at that point, and we have to then distill it, okay? So the beer is then run through what's called a beer still. It's this enormous still. And there's basically two kinds of stills, and you may have heard of this before. There's a pot still, and then there's what we use, which is called a continuous still or a coffee still. Not coffee like this. It's named after an Irishman, actually, named Aeneas Coffee. All of our things are all the things in the bourbon industry are invented by Scotsmen or Irishmen. Go figure. But it's a continuous still because a pot still, which is what they use in Ireland and Scotland. You use once, you distill your whiskey in it, and then you have to clean it out, and then put more in, clean it out. With a continuous still, you're constantly running whiskey through it, and so it's a much more efficient way of using it, and that's what we use in America. So essentially what you're doing with this is you take your fermented beer, and you essentially kind of gather it up in a well, and then you take it in this big, tall still, and the still has a series of plates in it that run zigzag like this. And the thick beer runs down these plates side to side, and as it runs down the plates, steam is blasted up through the bottom. And as the beer runs down and the steam is blasted up through the bottom, the alcohol, again, as I mentioned earlier, because it boils at a lower temperature, it blooms off the beer and it goes up to the top of the still, and it's captured in a special rectifying cap, a copper device at the top, and it condenses up at the top. And again, you can kind of see where it says vapor. It collects up at the top. And that, and this is a very cool thing, I always think, is whiskey is actually vapor. It's this vapor that comes off of this beer. And once it condenses as this clear water-white substance. But our whiskey is always, oops, there's our little animation, oop, little fire there, oop. And actually what comes out at the bottom, I should mention, once the beer comes out at the bottom and all the alcohol blooms off, we have stuff that comes off at the bottom of the still. We call it stillage, but the official name is stillage. What we really call it is slop. It's the result, it's the used, spent beer once the alcohol has been stripped out of it. And what we do with that is we give it to farmers that come to the distillery, and they take that liquid, and it is like the best feed in the world. And no, it doesn't have any alcohol in it. Everybody thinks, like, you know, you got drunk cows running around. It's like the best feed in the world, but it spoils. So farmers will come in and they'll fill up their tanker trucks with it, and then they'll take it away. But I'll give you an interesting fact about this, the stillage, when we get to economic impact in a minute. So anyway, once we finish running that through the still, at that point, it's about anywhere between 90 and 110 proof. We then run it, we essentially distill it again through what's called a doubler, okay? And that's essentially just another, like, another little still. It runs through the doubler, and that purifies it and raises the proof. And at that point, it raises the proof to about 160 proof, which, again, we saw earlier was the legal limit. So it runs it through the doubler, and it raises the proof again, and it goes into a condenser where it essentially comes out as a clear water white liquid. Again, goes into a cistern room, which is like a big tank, and then it goes into that new charred white oak barrel that I told you about. Here's what it looks like when it goes into the new charred white oak barrel. And then somebody hammers a bung into it. The bung is actually made of poplar, which swells, and so it doesn't leak or anything. And Oh, there's flavor. Yeah, new make bourbon is sharp grain. It tastes like corn. It's really sharp. It's really interesting to taste. It's always a great exercise to do is to taste new make bourbon. Taste bourbon at a year old, 2 years old, 5 years old, 7 years old, 12 years old, because you can really see the influence of the barrel at that point. But new make bourbon tastes very grainy and sharp. It's very hot. I mean, it's you know, it's interesting. I'll tell you a little story, a little bourbon industry story. You all ever heard of Booker No? Booker No Booker died two Februarys ago. He was the legendary master distiller from the Jim Beam Company, and Booker was a great bear of a man and a great master distiller and a wonderful ambassador for the bourbon business. But Booker used to like to drink White Dog, and that's what we call new make bourbon. It's called White Dog. That's what the distillers call it. And Booker liked, that's how he liked to drink it. He liked to drink it right off the still. And boy, I tell you, I mean, if you've had White Dog before, it's a hot drink. I mean, it is literally, it comes off hot. I mean, it comes off like hot. I mean, not just like burning, but temperature-wise, it comes off hot. But yeah, he used to like to drink it that way. But and the barrel influence is profound that it has. It really it not only softens it, but the caramel, vanilla, oak flavors that most people associate with bourbon actually do come from the barrel. So, okay, real quickly, and this is good. The timing is good. We'll talk real quickly about the economic impact of the bourbon industry, and I have to start with this one, taxes, because, man, do we pay them. We'll talk about taxes, employment, tourism, and agriculture. The agriculture one's real interesting at the end. So, you know, the distilled spirits industry in general is obviously heavily taxed, but the bourbon industry in particular in this state, for instance, in Nelson County, I got to tell you, the amount of whiskey that's aging in Nelson County essentially supports the school system in Nelson County. It really does. The ad valorem are property taxes that are paid on aging whiskey in Nelson County. So the taxes that are paid in excise taxes by the bourbon industry, about $900 million. The wholesale tax was just raised to 11% by our, thank you very much, by our government last year. It's amazing. I will, my one editorial comment, you know, Anheuser-Busch, Missouri takes care of them. Miller, boy, Milwaukee, Wisconsin sure takes care of them. Ain't the case here in Kentucky, I can tell you that much. They just raised the wholesale tax to 11%, so that's about $60 million for our industry. Just the on-premise at bars and restaurants, about $30 million in taxes. Here's the ad valorem tax on aging barrels in the statewide. It exceeds $1 billion for the industry. So a huge amount of tax burden. In terms of employment here in the state of Kentucky, over 3,000 people employed in the distilleries and the tourism industries that are associated with the distilleries. Very, very low turnover. As a matter of fact, this is increasing as the bourbon industry continues to grow in the state. Tourism, as the industry grows, tourism grows. We have what's called the Kentucky Bourbon Trail here in Kentucky. It's something that we're actually kind of just really getting going now. Six of the distilleries actually participate in the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. One of the distilleries really doesn't have the facilities to do it right now. But we actually have more than 500,000 visitors. We actually have a great, here's my little plug, we have a great facility at Heaven Hill that we just built about a year and a half ago, the Bourbon Heritage Center. So if anybody's interested, I brought some literature here. But it is a really cool facility, and it's not just about Heaven Hill and our brands and all self-aggrandizing stuff. It's about the bourbon business and the bourbon industry, and it's pretty interesting. And we do a little tour of the Rick House, and it's a good way to see the bourbon business. So, but the whole interest in the bourbon industry and tourism and the heritage and the legends and the people behind it has never been stronger. So that really is the point here. And we also have in September, if you all are familiar, we have the Kentucky Bourbon Festival that takes place in Bardstown. And I've been to every one. We just did the 16th one, and I've been to every one. And what started out as just a little teeny tiny kind of a local thing has just absolutely exploded to the point where it now brings in more than $4.5 million to Nelson County. This was actually 2 years ago. I couldn't get the figure for last year. $4.5 million just to Nelson County and $7.5 million statewide. I mean, it really has just become a huge event, and it's getting coverage just internationally. I mean, the Bourbon Festival really has become a big deal. So, and it's really just very cool to see that from an industry standpoint, particularly having seen it grow year after year after year to the point where it really has gotten to be a big deal. Last thing I'll just talk about, which I think is just kind of neat, is just from an agricultural standpoint. I did a presentation 2 days ago up in Bardstown to a group of retired soil conservation people. And I spent quite a bit of time talking about it. They were great folks, and they're all about, you know, soil conservation. And you know, I mentioned, you know, it's, you know, what they do is obviously critical to the bourbon business. But the bourbon, I mentioned earlier that the bourbon industry produces about 921,000 barrels a year. That's about 12 million bushels of grain, of which about 80% is corn. And all that corn, incidentally, is grown locally. That's pretty much all Indiana and Kentucky corn. It's all grown within about 70 or 80 miles of our distillery. And it's all actually family. I should point this out. Willie Nelson's, if you all are familiar with, Willie Nelson's got a bourbon, Old Whiskey River bourbon. And that's our bourbon. We supply that to him. And part of the reason he came to us for his bourbon is, you know, Willie's all about, he's about many things, as you know, but one of the things he's about is family farms and farm aid, and, you know, he started all that. And one of the reasons he came to us, aside from the fact that he liked our bourbon, was we buy from multi-generations of the same family farms, always, all of our corn in particular. Our rye and our barley we buy from up north, because that's where that stuff grows. But our corn we buy from the same families. So when he he came to our distillery, and we did a big press conference and brought the whole families and everything like that. But so it's all about buying the corn from the families. But anyway, so all that bushels of grain, that's about 119,400 acres of arable land that means that is being tilled. Now, each bushel of that grain, I talked earlier about the stillage that it produces, about 30 gallons of stillage to feed livestock. So we figure with all that livestock that we're producing 360 million gallons of stillage, and that's feeding about 12 million head of livestock just out of our distillery. And remember, there's 8 other distilleries in the Commonwealth. So lots of cattle, but fortunately, remember, they're not tipsy cattle, just good feed. So anyway, that's my presentation about the bourbon industry. If you all have any questions, hopefully I'll have some answers.
Yeah, questions back here.
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. And the answer is no. As a matter of fact, are you all familiar with a single barrel bourbon, what it is? Let me explain. In recent years, there's, you know, as bourbons have become real popular, there's kind of a couple of like special fancy bourbon terms and types that have become popular. One is called a small batch bourbon, and one is called a single barrel bourbon. And these really are in response to, they first started as a result of demand from international markets, in particular the Japanese market, because single malt scotches were so popular there, and they paid so much money for them over there, that they came to the American, and bourbons have always been popular in Japan, that they came to American bourbon producers and they said, do you have essentially the equivalent of a single malt scotch, a special bottling of a bourbon? And really, we did, but we never told anybody, because people like Booker No and R. Parker Beam always had what they called honey barrels in the warehouses. They always knew where there was a really great barrel of bourbon, like the best barrel of bourbon that they would dip the whiskey thief into, and they would take a little bit of it. They would never tell anybody. They always knew where in the rickhouse, always on the upper floors, always in a certain area of the rickhouse where the air circulation was real good and the sun would hit it real good. They always knew where the best barrels were, but they would never tell anybody. But when the Japanese folks came and they said, we will pay $300 for bottles of this, of your best bourbon, somebody said, okay, Booker, Parker, we want like the best bottles of bourbon we can get. They said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to take a single barrel of the honey barrel, and we're just going to dump that barrel by itself and bottle it by itself as one barrel, and then mark on that bottle barrel number, you know, 37097, and then move on to the next one. And that's what's called a single barrel bourbon. So that is truly kind of the purest expression of a single barrel of bourbon. This bourbon here can be like 500 barrels all mixed together. And with this one, we're trying to achieve a real consistent, so that this bottle tastes like the one you had 5 years ago, tastes like the one you're going to have 5 years. This is a single barrel bourbon, and it's designed to taste like it's like a snowflake. Everyone is supposed to have that idea. So I was a marketing person. So, but to your point earlier, we had a whiskey writer, actually, one of the whiskey writers on your little bibliography here. They gave you great bibliographies on the back of the sheet here. They picked out wonderful bourbon books for you. The last book here is The Book of Bourbon and Other Finds. This is like a seminal book on bourbon. And the people that wrote it is Gary Regan. He's a great friend of mine. He's coming in tomorrow night. We're entertaining him over the weekend. It just so happens. But he came in a few years ago, and this is one of our best-selling single-barrel bourbons. And with a single barrel bourbon, almost all of them on the back, it's written barreled on and barrel number. So that we would always write on here what the date that the bourbon was put in the barrel and what the barrel number. So people would be, oh, this is barrel number so-and-so. It's a single barrel bourbon, and it was put in the barrel. But Gary came to us and he said, you know, people always think that bourbon ages once it's put in the bottle. So you know what you should do? You should put the date that it was put in the bottle on there, as well as the date it was put in the barrel, so that people will understand that. So that's what we did. So this is the only single barrel bourbon that has that information on there, exactly to your question. So Gary, so it was like one of those things where, and Gary is a writer, next year he came back and we said, look what we did, Gary. He said, you know, that's the first time that a whiskey company has ever done anything that a writer has ever asked them to do. But yeah, your question is a good one, and we did that for that, exactly that reason, because everybody thinks that, you know, it ages. All it can do in a bottle is, if you don't take care of it, you can ruin it. If you leave it in sunlight, but if you take care of it, it'll be just fine. So, other questions?
Questions back here.
I was curious, how many different countries you guys ship to?
Bourbons? About 65.
Yeah. Is Ireland and Scotland?
Yeah. Yeah, the UK has become a big whiskey market.
I sell them on the shelf of China.
Yes.
I used to bring them to them, but now I don't.
China is, China is, they're struggling right now trying to figure out, we're struggling around with China trying to figure out some health issues with fusel oils, believe it or not. There are things in bourbon called fusel oils, and they're trying to figure out, we're struggling with some issues with China right now on something called fusel oils. But I think we've just recently come to an agreement with, we just met with their health minister, actually. I was in a meeting with them not too long ago. Interesting you should bring that up, but I think we've just come to an agreement with them, so.
Other questions? Can you this new hot pomegranate liqueur? Can you tell us what's in it and why it's such a big hit this year?
Sure. Pomegranates. Well, that was actually no surprise there. I mean, pomegranates are really, really hot, and it was actually about 2.5 years ago when we first started to see pomegranates being just very hot, and we figured that the first person out there with a good pomegranate liqueur wins, because the market probably isn't going to, you know, probably not have room for two pomegranate liqueurs. So we really got moving on this one, and we got a good pomegranate liqueur out there, and we feel like we're the first ones in there with it. But it's basically California pomegranate juice, and actually a lot of this had to do with the success of Palm Wonderful. If you all are familiar with Palm Wonderful, it's a pomegranate juice that's been out for probably about 5 years now. It's a little pomegranate shaped bottle, and it's become, but anyway, it's very good pomegranate juice from California, vodka, and actually it's got a little bit of tequila in it, and we struggled with that because, you know, we tasted it with lots, and we do a lot of dirty work, but we do a lot of tasting. But it's mostly our lab people that do a lot of tasting. But the tequila was important. It's just a little tiny bit, but it takes a little bit of the tartness of the pomegranate off. And we've had great reception from, you know, nowadays it's a good time to be in the distilled spirits business because, you know, the whole cocktail culture has really come back very, very strong. I mean, you know, the whole kind of like Rat Pack, you know, Dean Martin shaker thing. I mean, that was real big in the 50s, 70s, and 80s. God, that stuff was just dead and gone. Everybody was drinking, you know, wine spritzers and, you know, and now it's back with a vengeance. You go to New York and you go to the big cities and it's all about, I mean, everywhere here, you go to martini lists everywhere. Everybody's about chocolate martinis and, you know, flavored rums and flavored vodkas. And so these types of products are, you know, very, very popular now. So mixologists, bartenders, you know, these are important new roles nowadays. So we're having a great time with this product and introducing it to mixologists and bartenders. So,
any other questions? On behalf of WKU Libraries and our host here, Barnes & Noble, friends of the library, our sponsor, we want to very much thank Larry Kass for coming down from Louisville, up from busy schedule, to talk about Heaven Hill and the bourbon industry in Kentucky. And thanks very much, a little token of our appreciation.
Thanks.
If you have questions, you'd like to talk to Mr. Kass, please feel to come by and chat with him. If you are in need of a signature to get credit for your class, come by and we'll stamp your form for you. Thanks very much for coming out.
Thank you.